And thanks for tuning in to Valley Free Radio today, this afternoon now at 4:01, according to the studio clock. This is Out There every Wednesday from 4 to 5 p.m. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Normally, I would play my recorded promo off of my thumb drive, but my thumb drive is still in police custody. There'll be more on that story next month. For today's show, well, last weekend, I was in Kentucky at my family reunion, so I have a couple of clips from my family. Probably one of the highlights of the reunion, well, I don't know if highlight is quite the right word, but was when my one-year-old great-niece caught a water snake on her bare finger. Other clips I have for today, I have a little interview with Reggie, who works downtown. I see him when I'm doing downtown trash, talking about when he played for the pro or semi-pro baseball team in Brattleboro, the Brattleboro Maples, I believe he said they're called. Also, an interview with Mega, who was in front of City Hall this morning with a sign letting people know about the glyphosate that's being sprayed by the city today and ongoing, and health problems that that's causing her and other living things. Also, an interview with Kristen Brennan from Springfield, talking about being the biking midwife and setting up her bike so she can carry all the midwifery supplies she needs to see her clients. And maybe a couple of interviews with people in my family, back to family reunion, talking about what their sources of food are. And I think I'll start with something that I saw today that I hadn't seen. Like I said, I've been out of town for a lot of the last couple weeks, and I was doing downtown trash this morning. And there on the side of the PVTA bus, actually two buses, I think I saw it on the R41, which goes to East Hampton and HCC, and then also on the R44, which is a Florence-Northampton bus. But on one side of the bus, was on the advertising panel, was advertising for the U.S. Marines. And the image was a man in camouflage with face paint, I guess I would call it. And I don't remember what the first one I saw said. It said something about, you know, victory starts from within. And the other one was another, the other image was, I think, a few men in camouflage with automatic weapons. And the slogan was, again, something, some sort of Buddhist-like saying that they had twisted, which really made me think, yeah, you know, brainwashing starts from without, within. And so anyway, so, you know, I say that that was disturbing, just sort of to see the militarization and the brainwashing, and just thinking about also how if there was advertising on the side of the bus that showed other, you know, like weapons and supported the use of violence in that way. Like, I'm just curious what the standards are for the PVTA. I guess probably there's like movies. You see that in movie images a lot. I'm just so like uncorrupted and unnaive because I don't watch movies and see a lot of violence and stuff. Like, you know, I know it exists. You know, I see those planes going over to Westover, and I know they drop bombs and transport, you know, troops and all that stuff. And anyway, so at the same time today, this morning, I'm hauling a lot of trash, and I don't know, I've probably moved about 1,000 pounds of trash today, or waste, loading, unloading, and hauling it on my bike trailer. So I'm also, it's also on my mind, like, you know, why is it disturbing to me to see these images of how our lifestyles are really supported, in my opinion? Is that more disturbing than the trash that I'm hauling? Because it's the trash I'm hauling is really pretty disturbing too, and it's all tied together pretty closely. So maybe it's good to see what's behind the, what's defending the American lifestyle. What else? Oh, another little thought for today. I was doing my route, and I got a flat tire on the trailer, so I had to unload all my stuff. And then normally I would just patch the flat, but my little pump that I carry around with me is also in police custody. So I thought about riding to a friend's house because the flat was on the trailer and my bike was still good. I could just unhitch and ride. But I was like, I'm already running late. I'll just see if I can find a pump from the nearest person. I was on Cherry Street. And so, like two houses down, I knew that some people lived there that were probably likely to have a pump. Anyway, so I saw a woman in the driving lot. I was like, hey, excuse me. I didn't know her, but I was like, hey, excuse me, do you have a pump I can borrow? And she's like, sure, come on in. So we ended up meeting and talking, and she actually went to bike mechanic school. She works for All Out Adventures, and she gave me an apple and peanut butter and the pump and all these things. And we had a really nice connection, Jackie Brown. Hopefully, I schedule an interview with her for a future radio show. Hopefully, you'll hear from her in a couple of weeks. But my point is it's good to not have everything you need. That way you gotta ask for help and make some good connections. All right, first up for today's recorded part of today's show, here's Reggie. Oh yeah, I ran into him yesterday when I was doing downtown trash, and I was emptying the downtown trash trailer at the compactor behind the Green Bean, and he pulled up, and he drives like the orange Kubota kind of thing, and he does different plant watering and things around the town, and every now and then we talk a little bit.
Yeah, hi, I'm Reggie.
So Reggie and I both work downtown in the mornings, and you were just telling me, so you're from the Brattleboro, Guilford area, and you played baseball back in the day?
Yeah, for the Brattleboro Maples. It was considered a semi-pro team out of Brattleboro, Vermont. Uh-huh. And we traveled around New England and played a lot of teams that were pro teams, like the Vermont Reds and scrimmage against the Nashua Pirates, which was a double-A team, and played against a lot of former Major League Baseball stars. Uh-huh. So it was really fun. We got to travel a lot in, Saxon's River. We went to Keene. We went to Burlington, Vermont. Uh-huh. And it was really fun.
How old were you?
At the time, I was about 19.
Uh-huh. Did you play, were you out of high school, or where did you play?
Yeah, in between, it's summer ball between college.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So it was pretty fun. We all drove in like three or four cars. Some of the guys were closer to 30. So uh-huh. It was, we got to play against Bill Lee, who was a former Red Sox star.
Uh-huh.
He was from Saxton's River.
Uh-huh. So did you, with the people on your team, were some of them like hoping to be able to make it to more like major, or people content with where they were, or how was that?
It was competitive, and so a big part of baseball is learning to deal with failure, because 7 out of 10 times you might not get a hit.
Yeah.
And you're still batting 300, mm-hmm. which is a good number.
Uh-huh.
So it was really fun. It was about someone remembering a double play or a uh-huh. home run or uh-huh. something uh-huh. the next day or uh-huh. the next week.
Uh-huh. It's kind of a good metaphor for life, batting 300. Depending on the situation, that may be pretty good. I mean, has that helped you deal with, I don't know, how you see your, failure or success or interpreting those things during your life?
Yeah, baseball has been a real lesson learner. Mm-hmm. So being a pitcher, you're going to pitch. You can't win every game, and you're not always happy with the umpire.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all... it's all a good lesson for life, definitely.
Mm-hmm. How about the physicality of it and, continuing, you're trying to be physical during your work, the rest of your life?
That's a good question. I never really thought about it. There's more that goes into baseball, probably, for conditioning than people realize. Flexibility, and the games are long.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I would say it doesn't hurt. Mm-hmm. For conditioning, and again, it's there are disciplines within the sport and within the conditioning aspect that allow you to if you follow those throughout your life, it's definitely helpful.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
It's a rainy day, so we need some rain for everything. So thanks for the interview.
Yeah, you're out here watering plants.
Yeah. Yep. Yep. We have 70 hanging baskets right now. And maybe, I think I counted 28 potted trees and plants on the main and side streets. So I think we're going to add 30 more.
Of this, I just noticed
of the
big,
hanging plants,
okay.
Yeah.
And I just noticed those big birch trees,
yeah,
pots in the middle of Main Street.
Yeah, they're very pretty. It's something new. The DBA, I think, is involved, so people are always looking at different ways to add to the beautification, if you will, of Northampton. Uh-huh. It's pretty nice.
Yeah. So your work shift, what's your work shift like?
Like 4:30 to 12:30, 5 to 1.
A.M.?
Yeah, A.M., yeah. So, and then I go mow lawns in the afternoon, because it's a hard time to sleep, and it's too early to sleep at 2 o'clock, so... Yeah, it's fun.
Cool.
Northampton, there's a lot. If you can't find it here, maybe you just haven't walked down the right street yet.
Cool. Thanks, Reggie.
Yeah, thank you.
So that was Reggie. Say hi to him if you see him downtown in the mornings driving the little thing, truck, not quite a truck, the thing. Also from this morning's interviews, I have Mega. She was standing in front of City Hall.
Hi there. I'm Mega Amira. Northampton resident. I live near Smith College, close to downtown Northampton.
And you're out here today in front of City Hall with a sign that says the city of Northampton is spraying glyphosate poison today.
That's correct. Yeah. We just found out there were signs posted next to the Mill River near Smith College less than 48 hours ago saying there was going to be an herbicide application without any details about what chemical or product was going to be used. So we had to make a lot of phone calls, and it took all day yesterday. But finally, we were able to have them admit what it was, and it is glyphosate. And they said it's fine, it's safe because it's not Roundup, but glyphosate is the part of Roundup that is indicated in causing cancer and all sorts of other health problems and for wrecking ecosystems. And I think it's pretty awful that they're doing it, especially without proper notification to people about what they're doing.
Uh-huh. The city of Northampton is doing it on the levee on federal lands, or do you know about how
I don't know who owns the lands.
Yeah, okay.
That wasn't provided in the information they gave me, so.
Okay. How does it affect you personally?
Well, the reason that I have such awareness about this issue is because for the past 10 years I've been living near Smith College, and Smith does a yearly application to their lawns of a chemical called 2,4-D, which is also associated with many health issues through scientific studies. And I was getting sick every year in June, and I didn't know why I was going to my doctor with these mysterious symptoms every June, such as headaches, vomiting, joint pain, skin rashes, sores on my mucous membranes, and it would happen the exact same time each year. And I finally, after years, figured out that it correlated to when they sprayed. And it would be the day after that I would get really sick.
Yeah.
And so I've been struggling with that. I had to leave my house for the last couple weeks because Smith was doing that again. They say they're considering a shift to organic. So I encourage everyone to contact them and encourage them to make that shift, because all of the neighborhoods around Smith College and around the Smith lawns are getting exposed to 2,4-D, which is highly volatile, meaning it'll drift into people's houses, and it's especially dangerous to children and pets.
So Smith College, is there information on your flyer here about Smith College?
It isn't. We actually made separate flyers when we were doing, because it was a separate chemical for Smith. This we're focusing today on what Northampton's doing with the glyphosate.
Because
there's a lot of awareness coming recently into the public awareness about that herbicide.
Okay. So this show won't air until this afternoon, when I assume it'll always... They're going to continue to spray. It's like an ongoing thing.
I know.
Thing,
they're doing it. I'm not out here thinking that they're going to stop because I'm standing here with a sign. I'm doing it because people don't know what they're doing. And I think that if people knew, they would care.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we're trying to do, is raise awareness and educate people about what's happening so they can take measures to protect themselves, and also to encourage the city to make changes in their practices.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for being out here.
Yeah.
How does it feel? Have you been out here for other? Have you ever been out here alone, holding a sign?
I actually, my mother used to bring me to protests in downtown Northampton when I was a kid. I remember making signs when I was a kid because I grew up here. So I remember protesting with my mother. So I have her to thank, I guess, for showing me that this is something you can do if you want to speak up.
Nice.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks for being out here.
Yeah.
Right.
Have a great spring.
Thank you.
Please call the city.
Oh, Monsanto.
Oh.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Mega Amira in front of City Hall today. The flyer that she gave me. Well, okay, so the woman that stopped by that last word where she goes, ugh, Monsanto. The flyer says Monsanto first learned of glyphosate's cancer risk in 1983, and the EPA knew about it, but the EPA used research funded by Monsanto instead of independent scientific studies to determine whether glyphosate was safe. Monsanto paid a chemical industry front group, the American Council on Science and Health, to push back and hide the scientific findings on glyphosate's link to cancer. So, you know what? I think this is a good time to play a song. I'm going to play Burn Them. This is Black Stalin.
Get away. Money, money. Why? This is my time for money.
And that was Black Stalin with Burnham from around 1987, I think. And I don't know if you could catch the words, but here's one of the, you know, one of the verses is, Peter, wait, Peter, wait. Peter, look, Botha reached by the gate. With Botha, I don't want you to waste time. Remember, we still have Morgan behind. Peter, look, the Englishman, the Englishwoman who sent foreign troops in Africa land. Peter, I just don't care what you say. The Ku Klux Klan man can't get away. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Up to come today, we have a clip from my niece about her one-year-old daughter catching the water snake on her finger at family reunion last weekend. And some other, an interview with Kristen Brennan from Springfield about biking her midwife self around. So I think this is my niece, Rebecca, my nieces, Rebecca and Melissa.
So I wanted to see if we can retell the story of the water snake at Woodring Family Reunion 2019. So Rebecca, you were down on the dock with Jessie, she's 1 year old, right?
Almost one. She'll be one in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Yes, we were down there on the dock. I was dangling my feet in the water, splashing around, and she was laying beside me, splashing her hands in the water. And I glanced away for a couple seconds, and all of a sudden she started screaming, and I looked down, and there was a big water snake that had a hold of her thumb.
Yeah, I knew what happened, Jessie.
Then Mommy picked me up and yelled for help, and people came running. And what happened next?
Melissa?
Aunt Melissa grabbed the snake and squeezed really hard. Somebody else grabbed the snake too. I'm not sure who. And after a few seconds, it eventually let go.
It seemed like a really long few seconds. I was up on the bank watching, and like, I feel like you had hold of the snake by the neck right under the jaw, and you're like, it won't let go.
I'm just like, my poor baby. And screaming and streaming blood.
Yeah, and then once
the snake was longer than she was, looked like.
Yeah, and then once the snake did let go, then what did you do with it?
Uncle Chris took it and then he chopped his head off. He killed it.
Mm-hmm. And Jessie?
I picked out at least one snake tooth from her finger and tried to squeeze, at least get some blood out to clean the wound out some. Take her inside, wash it up, some drawing salve I had with me on it. And she was fine, pretty much, as soon as the snake let go of her.
Mm-hmm.
Once I stopped squeezing your finger.
Yeah.
Though it's all bruised and full of teeth marks still.
Yeah. Yeah, I looked at the head after Chris cut it off and opened it up, like in the teeth. There are just like these thin, slivery splinters, like that all pointed back towards the snake's throat. Yeah, I guess to help like push the food back there. And then like when I touched the teeth, I like brushed my fingertip across the teeth and it just like, it stuck in my finger like porcupine quills.
That's why she had at least one in her finger. Mm-hmm. So did it have just one row of teeth or was it several?
I don't remember. I wish I'd taken a picture.
I mean, look at her thumb. There's so many
rows like,
of teeth marks.
It's got like three or four bites.
Mm-hmm.
Three or four places where it clamped down. Yeah. Well, yeah, that was quite the image of the
you pulling up Jessie and the snake just like dangling off of her thumb.
she can say she caught a snake with her bare hand when she was 1 year old. Nice job, Jessie.
So that was my niece Rebecca and her daughter Jessie. They live in southwestern Virginia, and also my niece Melissa at our family reunion last weekend in Kentucky. And the rest of that story, well, first I should say that, yeah, my brother killed the snake. We had some mixed feelings about that, I think. Normally we don't kill snakes in my family unless they're, I don't know. I remember once when I was a kid and we were haying in the field and my dad was pitchforking hay onto the trailer attached to the tractor, and he pitchforked a pile of hay, and there was a copperhead in the bottom of it. And so he took the pitchfork and he pinned it to the ground right behind the head without hurting it. And he told my brother, he said to my brother was probably, I don't know, 12 at the time, 12 or 15. He said, all right, grab the snake and throw it across the creek. So my brother grabbed the snake, and I remember seeing that the image of that copperhead flying across the creek and landing in the woods on the other side. But then this, okay, so I think this snake, I think my brother probably killed it because he felt responsible for it biting. Like, he was hosting the, he lives there on the land, so he was like, he felt like primary host of the event, and the snake bit his one-year-old relative. So anyway, so then after it was dead, I was like, I was burying the fish heads and stuff. Oh, he also felt responsible because he had just thrown a couple of fish heads. We were cleaning fish. My sisters and nieces and nephews caught, like, my brother caught like 40 fish that we were having for supper. And so he had thrown some fish heads in the water, which I think may have attracted the snake. We call the snake Margaret. We call all the water snakes Margaret, just like we call all the black snakes Joe, just, you know, to keep on friendly terms with them. Anyway, but Margaret, or that version of Margaret, was now in a couple pieces. And so I asked my brother, I was like, well, she's dead. Like, should we eat her? And he said, I ate snake once before that was small, and it's just really not worth it, too many bones. But I was curious to see what was inside. I was curious to see what was in its abdomen, what it had been eating. Because last year at family reunion, there was a similar situation where we had caught fish, and we were down at the dock cleaning it, and my nephew, Richard, he had been scaling a fish, and so he leaned over the edge of the dock and washed the fish off in the water to wash off the scales. And when he pulled the fish back up, there was a water snake attached to it. And in that case, last year, he brought the water snake up on the shore and finally got the fish out of its mouth. And he set it on the shore, and then we actually gave the water snake a fish head and watched the snake swallow it, which it did. And then we gave it a bigger fish head, and then we watched it try to swallow that one. Anyway, so we have this relationship, usually a friendly relationship with water snakes. But in this case, the snake, Margaret, was killed. And so I asked my brother, like, should we eat it? But I was curious to see what was inside. So I peeled the skin back and was looking at the abdomen, but then what attracted my attention was down the line of the snakes, like after the I don't know, 4 or 5 or 6 inches of 7, 8 inches of I don't know, minnows and crawdad particles, whatever it had been eating. Then it had 40 eggs. They were yellow. They just looked like egg yolks about the size of a marble. And I counted, there were 40 of them. So I pulled them out. They were all attached on a, like in a sleeve, like a, it's hard to describe. It was very fascinating. Anyway, I asked my brother, I was like, well, we should probably eat them because why not, right? And so he put them in the blender and made the batter that he put the fish in with the snake eggs. And then the rest of the snake, I was thinking about if we should eat it or not, but then there were roundworms that were crawling on it. So I had reached my limit at that point. I was like, okay, I'm just going to go bury this in my dad's garden right now. Anyway, that's a little bit about my family and where I came from. So here's an announcement to make. By the way, you are listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. That story may have been more on the out there side. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. This is WXOJ LP 103.3 FM in Northampton. And coming up this Saturday, June 28th. Wait, is that Saturday? No, that's Friday. Friday, June 28th. Do I say first what it is or where it is? All right, what it is. Gateway City Arts presents a screening of The Breast Archives. Megan Murphy presents a film that's changing the conversation about women's breasts. June 28th, 7 to 9 p.m., $10 admission at Gateway City Arts, 92 Raceway Street in Holyoke. And then there's a panel discussion afterwards. I'm not sure exactly what the perspective is from this movie, but I will say that I changed my WhatsApp profile picture when I was in Kentucky. So now I have a picture of me in Kentucky holding a sign me without a shirt on, holding a sign in front of my breast that says, "So done with the double standard." I should have also put at the bottom, "Free the nipple." Yeah, as the weather gets warmed up, as the weather gets warm, and going without a shirt is the chosen dress for some people. I feel like people of all sexes and genders should feel free to go without a shirt if they want. But keep your shoulders covered for the sun, people. You don't want to get sunburnt. Be safe out there. All right, next we got, I'll play the interview with Kristen Brennan, the biking midwife.
Hi, my name is Kristen Brennan, and I live in Springfield, Massachusetts, and I am a home birth midwife.
And right now you're at the bike lab in Northampton. Wait, how did you get here today?
I biked here, of course, beautiful day, and I biked to see my friend Ruthie because I wanted some advice on how I can have more carrying capacity on my bike without using a trailer. We do have a trailer, but I want something that can be a little more consolidated and faster.
Plus, sometimes you put your bike on the bus, right, and trailer doesn't quite work.
Absolutely. I can't bring the trailer on the bus, and if I'm going between Holyoke and Northampton, want to make a quick trip, I like to put it on the bus.
So, what time did you get up this morning? What time did you leave the house?
Well, my day actually started a little later today at 7:30, and it takes me a little, you know, it takes about an hour and 20 minutes or so to get up to Northampton.
All right. Some people have asked me, they're like, wait, you can bike to Northampton from Springfield? It's not just all interstate?
It is not. There are some great roads. So from Springfield, I go through down St. James through Chicopee Falls and then up on Montgomery, which brings you down into Willimantic. And then over the bridge into Holyoke, and then just taking Route 5, which is actually a totally, of everyone knows, completely gorgeous route. And from Holyoke to Northampton is a lot downhill, so that's super fun.
Yeah. So as a midwife, what kinds of things... Okay, so how does this really work with, like, biking and not driving everywhere? Because you're always going to... Are you always going to different places, different people's houses?
Yes. Yeah, so primarily, we do our... clientele, like our prenatal appointments, in a small office in Northampton and in a small office in Springfield. So I'm able to bike to all of the actual appointments that I have with families. The question comes up when it's time for the birth, and because the births are not in a given place, they're in homes all around the valley, that's when the biking to births comes into question. Now, for my closer clients to Springfield, you know, Granby and Agawam and Chicopee and actually Southwick or Westfield, these are distances that if there's not an emergent birth, then I can get there. But if there's, we rarely use cars, but when I need to, for the longer distances, we have a car share relationship with another family in Springfield. So I would take a car to a birth, for example, in Greenfield, or a birth in, you know, maybe Florence, depending on the speed of which I needed to get there. But my dream is to be a local midwife to the Springfield area, the towns right around Springfield, and just to use this type of transit as much as possible. I always want to do the thing that's safest, but labor is often a process, and so just anticipating how long you have to get there is fine, and arriving there. And so making my bike able to carry all of the simple equipment that we need for a birth is really possible. I've done it with my current arrangement, but I just know that I could be doing it more efficiently.
The current arrangement is like a plastic crate on top of the rack. So what all do you have to take to...
So, you know, there are just basic clinical supplies, gloves and, like, instruments, and there's heating pads, and there's birthing stools, and there's oxygen tanks, and there's, I mean, not tanks, plural, but there's an oxygen tank. So it's not a lot of stuff, but it's enough different stuff that it makes a pretty big bag, and one that, you know, one that folks would think is a little much to carry on a bike, but when you creatively put it on there, I think it's possible.
That's cool. How do your clients react to, or if, do they see you, or do you hide the bike around the corner?
Well, I think I often hide the bike around the corner. I have a couple of clients. I have clients that after the birth, in the postpartum visits, when I arrive for postpartum visits at their home, on my bike, they're like, oh my gosh, you're on a bike. And I say, yes. And then it's okay after the birth has happened to just talk about biking and it's fine. But I would never want them to feel, you know, like, oh my gosh, my midwife's on a bike and I'm not sure if she's going to get here, because I always know I can get there and I have lots of different ways that I can make it happen. Mm-hmm. So the biking piece becomes a conversation generally postpartum, mm-hmm. when baby is born and mm-hmm. family is healthy, and it's just like the conversation can turn in that direction. Mm-hmm. I hope one day, I mean, there's that awesome like show, that Called the Midwife show, about the, you know, births in London with the midwives going to births on bikes through the city streets. And I think it could transform into like a positive association. I'm just not sure if families are ready for that. So sometimes I'm a little more careful with the information, so as not to. It's also their pregnancy, their birth, and so the little details of my transport or my existence are not like forefront.
Yeah. Why? Okay, I'm just trying to figure out why people like. Okay, I'm aware that it is a cultural, you know, discrimination stereotype thing, but like. You mentioned people might not trusting the reliability of your transportation, mm-hmm. but why would people think have any less respect or confidence in you based on your transportation mode?
Well, I don't know. There's maybe a culture around home birth in general, that like home birth midwives are trained differently. There might be just some like, you know, there's a great video about a movie about the granny midwives down in the South, like the black midwives who served like large stretches of communities. And there's a couple scenes in this documentary in which you see a young child run up to the midwife's house and knock on the door and like, mom's ready, mom's getting ready. And the midwife packing her small leather bag, which like she holds in her arm, just like in her hand, and just walking out the door and starting the 3-mile walk, the 5-mile walk, or whatever it is, mm-hmm. to get to that birth. And it's really beautiful. And the, you know, just set scene. Our relationship to medicine or healthcare has a very formalized tone, clearly, and mm-hmm. Maybe polished and fancy in some way. Mm-hmm. So the combination of deciding to do your birth at home actually potentially is the type of family who might say, oh yeah, bike, that's great. But I do think maybe culturally we still have this like, what are home birth midwives for real? Do they know what's going on? Do they know how to deal with an emergent situation? Those different questions that already arise with that alternative choice. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes I think maybe with that, or at least I perceive that with that extra step of if the transportation were not conventional, then it sort of might add to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really like how you're setting a good example of like healthy living from the time from before the baby's even born.
Well, thank you. I often feel like I arrive at appointments and at births when I'm biking with a deep sense of like life and energy, which mm-hmm. any biker knows. Like, of course, mm-hmm. you just arrive alert. And so I think it actually is a good practice even for the actual care of the family.
Do you want to mention the name of your practice? In case people are trying to get a hold of you?
Sure. I work for River Valley Midwives, and our main office is in Thorne's Marketplace, the 3rd floor. And if you're ever interested in talking to someone about home birth, please do give us. We're online, so you can find our website, or should I give a phone number?
Sure.
The office phone is 413-256-6166, and I would answer the phone. I carry it around, and I work with a partner midwife who drives a car.
Mm-hmm. Anything else you want to say?
No, thanks for having me.
Thank you. Good luck carrying all your stuff.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. Hi, my name is
That was Kristen Brennan from Springfield. When I said that we were talking at the Bike Lab this morning, the Bike Lab is regular open hours every Saturday from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at 12 Northern Avenue. You can come and learn to fix your bike, or just borrow tools or scavenge parts, or meet bike-friendly people, hang out. What else can you do? Have a good time, bike-related. You can donate bikes, too. I'm collecting bikes from our project to ship bikes to Trinidad. Working bikes, mostly, or close to working bikes. No, they don't have to be working, but bikes with most of their parts are really good. Also, Kristen's story reminded me when she talked about biking from Springfield regularly. So when I came back from Kentucky over the weekend, this past weekend, it's always a bit of a journey. This time I got back by, well, first I grabbed my mom's old 10-speed out of the basement and biked most of the way to Knoxville. I biked about 60 miles, hitchhiked about 20 or 25 miles, and then ran with my backpack the last 3 miles. That's from my friend's house where I stashed the bike from the Catholic Worker on the south side of Knoxville, Tennessee, to the bus station. And then I was on the bus for about 30 hours, 28 hours, but there was a misconnection on my bus, and so I missed the last bus to Northampton. And I got into Springfield at 12:30 in the morning, and I thought, what the perfect time to ride a Valley Bike Share bike. I'd actually never ridden one before, even though I've been a member for a year, so I had the membership. But the thing is, to check one out, there's a few different ways you can do it. For me to check one out with my membership, either I needed the fob, it's called, the little keychain with the plastic electronic doohickey, or I could do it with a Wi-Fi app thing. And I didn't have the fob because I don't travel with it, because I don't need it on my travels, usually in Kentucky or wherever. But I did have this device with Wi-Fi. So at 12:30 in the morning, well, the dock at Union Station in Springfield was all empty, no bikes there. So then I went to Court Square, but I couldn't get a bike unlocked there. So then I went to MGM Casino, my first visit to the casino in Springfield. And I managed to go inside into the lobby and ask the bouncers or security guards, hey, I don't have ID. I just want to use the Wi-Fi. So I got onto the Wi-Fi on the app, and I unlocked a bike out across the parking lot, according to my device. When I say device, I mean the thing people would normally call like a smartphone or an iPhone or something like that. But the term smartphone doesn't sound right, and I think iPhone is a brand name. So I just call it my device. But by the time I got out to the Valley Bike Share dock, the bike was locked. So then I went back into the MGM, into the studio, into the lobby, and was like, oh, sorry, I need to use the Wi-Fi again. And I did it again, and it said bike unlocked. And I went back out to the bike rack, and the bike was locked. And I was like, how am I going to get back to Northampton? It's 1 a.m. And then I remembered, I remember sometimes last year they said, if one bike doesn't work, try another one. So then I tried another bike, and it unlocked. I've heard since that if you unlock a bike with the Wi-Fi, you have 10 seconds to take it out of the dock before it locks up again. So if I had known that, I bet that if I had unlocked it from the studio or from the lobby of MGM and then ran across the parking lot, I bet I could have made it in less than 10 seconds and got a bike unlocked the first time. Anyway, I got a bike. I rode that one bike all the way back to Cooper's Corner. It took about an hour and 40 minutes, and then I just paid the extra charges for exceeding my time, which I think was, that was $4. But it was worth it for a summer solstice, Friday night bike ride from Springfield to Florence, the last leg of my trip back to Kentucky, from Kentucky. Anyway, thanks for listening. This is Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. A couple other announcements I want to make. Last night was my housemate Alex Jarrett's launch party for his Ward 5 City Council campaign. The election is November 5th, but Alex has been door knocking and going to meetings and meeting people and talking about his platform and actively engaged on all the issues of his platform too, because that's just how he is and what he does in life. I hope to interview Alex soon. I recorded things from the launch party last night, but why am I going to play a recording when I can get Alex Jarrett live, I bet? He's a great guy. Let me just say that. And what else? Oh, today is Wednesday, so the Florence Farmers Market is going on right now until 6 p.m. Now, I think I'll play an interview with my brother-in-law, Greg, and my sister, Gigi. This is also from Family Reunion. I think after we ate the water snake eggs, I was thinking about, I should ask different members of my family where they get their food from. So, Greg, what are some of the sources of food in your household?
Well, the one probably most interesting source is from a local produce auction that gets food from a variety of sources. The main, one of the main sources is a big food distributor in our area.
Which is Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Right, which is Lancaster, Pennsylvania. That distributes food to lots of grocery stores, and they have either overstock or stuff they can't sell or stuff that gets returned for whatever reason. And then it comes to the auction and happens once a week on Tuesdays. And there can be probably 60 to 80 people there bidding on produce that can be range from bananas to peppers to lettuce, kale, and strange thing, turnips, platanos. I'm getting to that. So that's the produce side. And you can get, I tend to bid on organic things. So I've gotten like a case of organic chard that's in decent shape for $1, mm-hmm. or kale for $3, or peppers, 24 decent organic peppers, beautiful organic peppers for like $6-$7 for a case of 24.
So what do you do with a case when you get stuff in this kind of volume?
So the peppers, I got that one day, I got like 5 cases of 24 peppers each. So I went through, we like saved out like 24 for eating. Like they last pretty well in the fridge. But the rest then I just chopped into slices and froze. And so they're still in our freezer and we put them in soups and stir fries. And
make a lot of friends? Or barter with them?
And given away some, mainly family and friends, although setting up a whole distribution network is very like challenging and a whole extra step. Just getting home and then dealing with like processing stuff that needs to be processed, like oranges that are few have need to be used right away or stuff like that. So, but then the other thing they also sell at this auction is like a variety of grocery items. Like they get like things from grocery stores that are like out of the sell-by date, past the sell-by date. So they need to, the stores can't sell it. So they come to the auction, and the auction then sells it in usually decent-sized case boxes of
it's okay. Don't worry about
all anything you can imagine from grocery store, from ground coffee to peanut butter to salsa.
To race car-shaped gummy bears.
Gummy bears, cookies, crackers. I mean, it's all mixed together. So if there's granola bars and granola, and so I've been on boxes there, and we get stuff for our pantry, and I mean, gallon jars of mayonnaise or mustard. Now, some things we don't really use, and I try to pass on somehow, or sometimes it's just compost. But
do you know what happens to the stuff that isn't sold at auction?
My guess is, like, some of the stuff they can't sell ends up in the dumpster just because it's, like last week there were raspberries that they said looked a little rough. And when they say that, you know they're fairly rough. And I got 24 boxes for 50 cents, and they were largely moldy.
Yeah.
So I picked out maybe a box worth. It wasn't really worth my time.
Did you compost them?
And then we have decent composting, which my beautiful wife deals with. compost gets used a lot.
Yeah. All right, Gigi, you're over here smiling and nodding. Do you have any? How's the food auction? How's Greg's food auction habit for you?
When first Greg would go and come back with stuff, I'd be so excited, and then we'd like help him like put it up and deal with it. And now it's like, well, if I like it, I want to use it, I'll use it. And if not, I'll like, okay, you bought it, you have to deal with it. Because sometimes it's like a lot. We have a whole extra refrigerator in the basement that, you know, could be completely full along with our refrigerator in our kitchen. And when there's only 3 of us, you know, there's only so much food we can actually eat.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's great to put it in the freezer, but then the freezer gets full. But there are some good things that I have enjoyed.
We've also, at least in the fall and winter, we're doing, like, monthly, like, community meals, so we get a chance to use big quantities of things or invite people over. So that's one of the hopes for the future, is to have more kind of events where we can have larger groups and use up chunks of produce.
Yeah, more family reunions.
Right, right, more family reunions. And, yeah, when you cook greens, like, they really cook down. So even if you have 10 pounds of greens, you're still cooking them down to manageable, eatable levels.
Yeah. That was an interview with my sister Gigi and her husband Greg from my family reunion in Kentucky. You're listening to Out There. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. Out There airs every Wednesday from 4 to 5, followed by Democracy Now! Coming up at 5 o'clock here on Valley Free Radio. And before my show, from 3 to 4, is Mary Rewired. Here's an announcement coming up on July 6, 2019, in a week and a half. Speakers from the LGBT Asylum Task Force to discuss their experiences in a free program. On Saturday morning, July 6th, Racial Justice Rising and LGBT Asylum Task Force will present a free program. LGBTQI asylum seekers share their experiences. The July 6th program, which is open to the public, will be held at the First Congregational Church, 43 Silver Street in Greenfield, Massachusetts, from 10:15 a.m. to 12:15 p.m. Doors open at 9:45. For more information or to reserve free childcare, contact email at racialjusticerising.org. Racial Justice Rising, based in Franklin County, offers a free program one Saturday morning most months and are also known for their weekly Saturday morning vigil for racial justice on Greenfield's Town Common. I guess I got one more story from my family reunion. So my nieces and nephews who are teenagers that were there, there were five of them, they were going to camp in the field. There's lots of cows and goats, and it's like a lot of pasture and mountainside. Anyway, but one of the flat areas, so they were going to camp in for the weekend, and so they put up this tent, a really big tent, like a three-room tent, basically. And they put it up in the afternoon, and then in the evening, they were taking their bedding out there. I think it was maybe dusk, and they went out with a couple armloads of bedding. Like the second trip out, my niece Milka, she said when she got to the tent, they had left the door open of the tent. And when they got there, she saw some legs inside and she thought it was her brother. But when she got close, she realized it was a cow inside the tent. So she went inside to try and herd it out. But the cow just kind of panicked and let loose some cow patties and ran into the one wall of the tent, ran into another wall of the tent, ripped the tent open in a few places, broke all the tent poles. You can imagine, a cow is a big thing to have in a tent. And in my imagination, the tent is like tumbling across the pasture with Milka and the cow's legs spinning. Anyway, eventually everyone made it out of the tent alive. The tent didn't quite make it. That's all I got for today. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Thanks for listening to Out There, and enjoy the rest of your day.
You can buy it.